Belonging and inclusion is a strong need in all of us, and as we and our organisations wrestle with how to do this well, we need to tap into all of the wisdom out there to help navigate that. And there is no better a source of wisdom than Sally Helgeson, author of Rising Together, who I talk with here, about how we can create more inclusive workplaces. Hi, I'm Penny DeVolk. Welcome to Grit in the Oyster, a podcast offering insights for women leaders. Why grit in the oyster? Well, because an oyster makes pearls from a foreign object or irritation. And that's often how we can feel as women leaders in organizations today. The trick is not to get spat out, but to grow into that natural gem. Through conversations with leaders and experts in the field of women in leadership, I hope to offer insight and inspiration as well as practical advice, helping you navigate those grit in the oyster moments or times in your career. It's an opportunity to reflect, to step out of the fray, to tune out some of the noise, and tune into being the best leader you can be. It's such a pleasure to introduce you to Sally Helgeson. Sally is cited in Forbes as the world's premier expert on women's leadership. She's an internationally best-selling author, speaker, and leadership coach. She's been inducted into the Thinkers 50 Hall of Fame and is ranked third amongst the world's thought leaders by Global Gurus. Sally's latest book, Rising Together, How We Can Bridge Divides and Create a More Inclusive Workplace, builds on the success of her book, How Women Rise, co-authored by Marshall Goldsmith. Her latest book, Rising Together, offers practical ways to build more inclusive relationships, more inclusive teams, more inclusive workplaces. In its first week, it was Amazon's number one top seller in its field. Her other books include The Female Advantage and The Web of Inclusion, which is cited in the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books on leadership of all time. Sally, welcome.
Thank you, Penny. It's wonderful to be with you again.
And so lovely to speak to you again. Gosh, it has been 5 years almost to the day I interviewed you on my podcast. And we were speaking then about your book, How Women Rise. And well, what a 5 years it's been, including another really important book of yours. Yeah. So what has been happening for you in that time, Sally? And how did your latest book, Rising Together, evolve?
Well, a lot has been happening. How Women Rise did extremely well. If we were doing this with video, you'd be able to see my Mongolian edition on the shelf behind me. We've sold in 24 languages.
Love it.
So it's been quite wonderful, the whole experience of it, working all around the world with that book. I'll tell you how with Rising Together, I was doing a program, a women's leadership program, at the Construction Super Conference in Las Vegas. It was a huge, huge conference. There were about 6,000 people there, probably 5,500 of them men. And as you can imagine, it's construction industry.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, you want a women's leadership segment? Fine. And I was out there and I went down to my room. And I said, well, what do I expect? They said, well, last year we had about 100 women who'll be there. So, you know, they'll be struggling with issues in the construction industry. So I went down to the room. There were about 300 people there. I'd say 60 to 70% of them were men. I was so surprised. I realized that the remarks that I'd prepared for this session were not appropriate because they were very much directed at women. So I said let me survey the audience first. You know, I was kind of tap dancing because I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
Why did you, what brought you here? And I wasn't surprised. A lot of the men were saying, you know, we're having a terrible time attracting and retaining talented women. That's who's in the workforce now. We've got to get better at it. And we're not. So we thought it'd be helpful to come here. And then one man stood up. He was a construction executive. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, you know, we don't need you. Please don't waste your time telling us why we need to get better at this. We understand. We just don't know how to do it. We don't have a clue. And I thought, you know, it's not just women. It's most organizations they understand the need for addressing diverse employees. That's who's in the workforce now. It's a very diverse workforce. Yeah. In most sectors, in organizations all around the world. Penny, I've worked in 37 countries. This is what I see. But they don't know how. The tactical, mm-hmm. practical, how do you do this part? And I think it's one reason they've reverted to a lot of unconscious bias training just as something to do, because they don't know what to do. And it's not that effective. So I thought, that's my next book.
Fantastic. And I think what I really, one of the things I really value about this book is not just the nature of its practical advice, but also it's the timeliness of its message, Sally, the wisdom you bring to understanding the context we're living in. Because, you know, in those 5 years, things have changed. How we can navigate this new world powerfully and constructively. And I wonder if we can start our conversation with what you think are some of the critical components we're living with currently that are at play, that may have shifted in the last few years, that affect our ability to create cultures of inclusion or not?
Well, one of the big things, obviously, that has impacted our ability to create cultures of inclusion has been the pandemic. And the pandemic, certainly I see it in the United States, has created a more inward-looking culture. People are not out and about in the way they were. Obviously, also, many, many workplaces are either hybrid or virtual. This has many advantages for people, but it makes it harder to build relationships in a kind of casual way that relationships evolved when we were all constantly working together and people were going out for beer after work or coffee, whatever. You know, running into coworkers in a coffee in the line at Starbucks downstairs in your building.
All those things in a more natural way.
Yeah, exactly. Now it has to be very intentional, except for full-time workplaces. And people are, as a consequence of a lot of things that happened in the pandemic, in particular labor shortages, are more stressed. They have more work put on their shoulders, and they've had less time to recoup. So I think all those things, and then add to that the divisiveness in many cultures over issues of social change that has made people feel skittish around those they may feel are very different than themselves. All those things play into it. So I think this is, on one hand, a tough time for inclusion. On the other hand, I do think it is a time in which organizations have finally recognized that this, you know, this business of a diverse workforce, and I'm not just talking about demographically diverse, but in terms of people's values and what they aspire to and how they want to be treated and and their experiences. I think there's a real acceptance of that, and that gives us a stronger platform for moving forward. It's not just lectures about diversity and inclusion. This is about you know, doing something helpful with your work, with your workplace.
Yeah. And so, yes, so no one's really building the business case anymore for it. Everyone knows what they want to do, but it's the how. So when you look at practices, what sort of practices would you recommend to help create cultures of belonging for organizations to start with?
Well, I think there are two things, Penny, and this is how I've really approached and I could say structured Rising Together, the book Rising Together. The first is, I think we don't have, when we're in a highly diverse situation and people have very different experiences, values, backgrounds, etc., we have a lot of, you know, inflamedness around gender and racial issues. So when we're in those situations, we can feel triggered by something. We can feel triggered by fairness, for example. And I hear this all the time. Oh, mm-hmm. our company is really only promoting women now. This company only promotes men. This company only really seems to promote and privilege people of color. Oh, this is a kind of company where only white people get a break. I mean, you hear those things over and over and over again. And so I think there's often a perception that things are unfair. Now, they're often unfair. This is not to say this isn't a reality. Mm-hmm. But the issue is we don't have generally a way to deal with those perceptions. So people who have those feelings kind of get stuck with them. And I see this, and I see it in sort of complaining sessions.
Yeah.
In employee resource groups or networks or in private conversations or in the conversations and interviews I do with people. You know, I feel this organization is very unfair. You have to belong to this all boys network. Yes, there's some women in it, whatever. Mm-hmm. So issues like that, like fairness, are very volatile. Visibility is another issue that's very volatile. People who are not particularly good at bringing a lot of attention to what their contributions are can feel triggered by people who are, oh, what a showboat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that person's always, this very high opinion of themselves and nobody else can get any air around here. And this is exacerbated again by the pandemic and the fact that so much of our work is done virtually. So there's that trigger of visibility. And then people who are very good with visibility are often triggered by people who aren't. Well, he doesn't speak up. Mm-hmm. If you can't represent your own achievements, it's not my job to help you. You hear these things all the time. And it's fine. Guess what? Triggers, we're all triggered by this, that, or the other. We can't control them. They're environmental. Mm-hmm. They're vested in people, places, and situations. But we need, and I think this is an important part of helping people navigate this workplace that we're part of today. We need an effective way to address situations in which we feel triggered that serves us, that helps us move forward, that helps us collaborate perhaps with people that we, that trigger us. So this is true for fairness. It's true for visibility. Yep. I look in the book at 8 different triggers. How we build networks is a big one, how we communicate, et cetera. You'd think that somebody at that level mm-hmm. would be more skilled, more empathic, et cetera. So we need a better way to deal with triggers. So I talk about that in the book, and there are a lot of ways to deal with them. But one way not to deal with it is to grab somebody who you think shares your opinion about the person who just triggered you and talk about how awful they are. And this is what we're often reduced to. So that's an important thing. And I write in the book a lot. I've got a lot of techniques around that, around reframing.
And to move away from amplification of that. And you talked also about the stories we tell ourselves that can limit our ability to respond to triggers rather than just react. Are these the sort of stories you're talking about?
That's exactly it, Penny. We tell ourselves stories that make us feel better. That person's always sucking up air. Let me give a good example because we're talking a little theoretically now. And I'm going to use a very common example because I've watched this for the 35 years I've been in this field. You're in a meeting and a woman will say something. She'll present an idea, just, not formally, not a big presentation, but hey, have we ever thought of this? No one responds. Mm-hmm. Then 5-10 minutes later, another person, often a man who's more senior than she is, mm-hmm. will basically say the same thing. And everybody goes, "Ooh, what a great idea. That's terrific." And she's sitting there like, okay, what do I do? It's very unattractive to raise your hand and say, well, I said it first, it's very sort of first grade.
Yeah. That was my idea.
You know, if you're quick on your feet, you might be able to say, oh, I'm so glad you agree with my idea. That's terrific. Not in a sarcastic voice, but mm-hmm. just in an affirming voice. But often we don't really have that ability to think on our feet. We feel blindsided in the moment.
Yeah.
So rather than telling ourselves the story, and I see it all the time, can you believe it? That guy, he said the same thing I said, and everybody jumped on board. This place is so unfair. I can't get any, you know, visibility around here. Instead mm-hmm. of telling ourselves that story, we can choose to tell ourselves a story that helps us move forward. We can choose to tell ourselves a story such as, maybe he didn't hear what I said, or maybe he was just affirming it, but he did it in a way that wasn't necessarily obvious. So then if you tell yourself that story, even if you don't necessarily think it's true, and that's what's so fantastic about telling ourselves stories that give us a path forward, we don't even have to believe they're true. We can, in our hearts, believe that guy was just liked our idea, grabbed it, got a response. But if we tell ourselves that story was just trying to amplify what I say, then we can, you know, go up afterwards on the way out of the meeting. We can, mm-hmm. you know, send him an email. We can give a call and say, look, I was so glad yesterday in the meeting that you amplified the point that I made. I see we're in agreement on that. Wondering if there's some way we might move forward on this, since we both think it's a great idea. Now, a lot of times people will say, if I suggest this, say in coaching, they'll say, well, you know, no, I don't want to give him, I was the one who had the idea. Guess what? He's already claimed the idea. So what you want is for it to be both your ideas. That's more constructive. So you have the potential to take that person and find some way forward to a collaborative relationship with him or her. And even if they say, I'm not, you know, I was just kind of talking about it in a meeting. There's not really a way that I can see to move forward here. Remember, you put them on notice that you noticed, you know, that what they did.
Yeah.
And you're there in the idea. And so you've given yourself a kind of a path forward, and you have demonstrated to that person that you are willing to give them the benefit of your goodwill. And this is rare. And people are often changed when someone gives them the benefit of their goodwill.
Very interesting, isn't it, that you talk about that, you know, reframing, changing the dial from grievance to assuming positive intent.
Yeah.
Why is assuming positive intent such a challenge today? I mean, it's always has been something we need to be deliberate about to be able to pause and respond and not react. But it seems to be more challenging now to do that, to assume positive intent in these polarizing times. It's like our radars are out prickling with offense and grievance finding.
That's absolutely true. And that's something that we need to really address. Why is it particularly on high alert now? I think that there are, you know, on the positive side of that, so many people have come into the workforce feeling like, you know, I want to be myself here. People, you know, we're always talking about authenticity. I want to be myself. You know, I'm gay and 30, I'm just talking hypothetically here with somebody. Person thinks I'm gay. And 30 years ago, if I had this job, I would have to pretend I was not. Women come in and they're, you know, they're feeling as if they want to be who they really are in the workplace, certainly true for people of color. And they feel a certain amount of, you know, I couldn't have done this before. And so there's a real desire for self-assertion that's very normal here, because this is new, real desire for self-assertion. And often that self-assertion becomes to some degree defensive. And there are often reasons for it to become defensive, for us to become defensive, because there are, you know, these microaggressions that are constantly happening. But guess what? They are micro. And people, and a lot of them are just, you know, people saying dumb things, not because they're terrible people, but because they're not necessarily thinking in the moment. So I think that in our culture, we are primed to focus. I think the language of microaggressions has not served us in any way, because we're very primed to focus on where somebody might be actually thinking this, that, or the other. And so that feeds this divisiveness. I think that it's very important that we now have this awareness of unconscious bias and how unconscious biases shape our own, you know, awkwardness in certain situations. I think that's a positive thing. But a lot of the work that's been done in organizations on diversity has been focused on unconscious bias and microaggressions. And this is the polar opposite of giving people the benefit of our goodwill and the benefit of our doubt. And so the environment has kind of encouraged people to focus on, well, that person's this and that person's that. And I really don't think that it serves us that well. Obviously, you know, flagrant unfairness we need to call out. But also there's a lot of unfairness that is just, you know, sort of baked into the pot in organizations in terms of how people are promoted and who gets noticed, et cetera, et cetera. And what's required really is positive ways to try to address that rather than just standing from the point of view of a critic and talking about all the things that are wrong. And I am not, I've been out there a long time. I've been in the, you know, when I started working, it was in the Mad Men era and I was in the advertising business. This is back in the 60s. You know, I know these were not microaggressions. These were major aggressions. I know.
Macro.
Macro, exactly. So, you know, I know these are realities and they're very, very tough to deal with. But I don't think going in sort of primed to discover what's wrong or how this person might be manifesting unconscious bias and, you know, all the little kind of ways that we might feel offended. I think that there's an encouragement on that, and it has not served anybody. It's put us all in a lousy mood, too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really helpful because, you know, you and I are both very familiar with the double bind for women in management, where the think leader, think male stereotype is still so pervasive and, you know, prevents a very real challenge for women stepping into their leadership identity. And it isn't fair. Yet, you know, we see that thought in itself as a trigger, is what you're saying. So that can push us into sort of silos of identity-based complaint and get women stuck there?
Yes, that is very, very much what I have observed. And, you know, I've been writing about women and women's leadership for 35 years. And my focus has always been on two things. Number one, how can women best represent their potential, their achievements? How can they get noticed for it? And how can that help boost them and move them forward? But also, how can women and other diverse employees recognize what's getting in their way and find a way to address that? And here's one of the things that I think is happening. Can I talk about networks for a moment?
Absolutely.
You know, this is part of it. I've noticed a lot through the years, resentment of kind of the old boys network. And the old boys network is a primary feature of it, is that people are very invested in one another's career. So once you are a part of that old boys network, and of course, given the composition of the workforce, there are now women who are part of Old Boys Networks, but they're still kind of what we think of as Old Boys Network, the inside group that has the inside track. And what's so I've watched a lot of situations, especially with the development of women's networks as real internal, sometimes real internal powerhouses within organizations, mm-hmm. where the idea is, you know, well, we're not an all boys network, you know, we're inclusive. And this was always the weakness of the all boys network. They tended not to be inclusive. But the strength of the all boys mm-hmm. network was the degree to which people recommended those who were in it, you know, pushed the members, the people who were part of that forward. And that's one thing that other people can really learn from Old Boys Networks, how we turn this mm-hmm. into a resource for everyone within its career to develop. And there are real ways to do that, which I talk about in the book. And so it's kind of, you know, turns on its head all the frustration around the existence of Old Boys Networks. Again, it gives it kind of the benefit of our goodwill. Okay, I'm not part of that. Mm-hmm. They don't seem that interested in me. You know, let me and some of my colleagues, let's start our own network where we really, really invest in one another's development and push one another forward, identify, you know, recommend, nominate, highlight, shine a spotlight on so that we too
advocate, amplify. Yeah, yeah.
All those words. So, you know, there's a lot of tactical things that we as individuals can do here to build stronger relationships and to help move ourselves and other people that we perceive to be like us forward.
Yeah. I love that. I also love the concept of interpersonal Aikido. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. Interpersonal Aikido is a wonderful concept where you take a situation and through giving another person the benefit of the doubt, you basically turn a situation around on them. I have a couple examples in the book. A woman that I interviewed who was a senior military officer, she was at West Point. And throughout her career, she'd had lots mm-hmm. of problems getting, you know, whenever a senior officer passes a more junior officer, that junior officer is supposed to salute them and say something like, you know, good morning, ma'am, in her case, not sir. And she had a lot of problems with that. And she would have junior officers pretending they didn't see her. And she knew why that was, that they did not want to acknowledge that a woman had higher status. And so what she began doing, because it made her feel terrible, is she felt like she couldn't just let them get by with it. So what she did was she kind of looked at them right in the eye and said, good morning, soldier. I guess you didn't see me. So she turned the tables on them by sort of forcing them to respond. They didn't have much choice then to salute her. Sorry, ma'am, I didn't see you. Salute, you know, jump to attention. Mm-hmm. And she said what she decided to do was to never question their story about they didn't see her. She said probably 1 out of 10 cases mm-hmm. it was true. 9 out of 10 it was not. They saw her. They didn't want to salute her. But she was able to sort of turn the tables on them and get that recognition. There's another wonderful example of what I call interpersonal Aikido, which is really, it's kind of a strategic way for turning situations in which we feel we are not being recognized or valued, turning those situations around. And it was a fellow who was a technology guy out in Silicon Valley. His family background was Korean, so he was taught to be very, very, you know, deferential in the presence of his superiors. And he was having a very hard time because the head of his company, who didn't really understand the technology, brought him along on all of his pitches that he did in Silicon Valley, trying to raise money from venture capital, relied on him heavily for that, but in tended to talk over him and be quite disrespectful to him. And he didn't know how to handle it. And one before one meeting, his back went out. He went to the chiropractor. And the chiropractor said, "I want you to stand. It's important that you not sit, because, you know, for your back." So I went into the meeting and he was standing. And he said, "You know, I've got to stand. My chiropractor told me I've got to stand." And what he found was that by standing, his boss did not talk over him. And he was able to compel the attention of the people in the room. He said when he went to the next meeting, the boss tried standing up as well, but it was awkward and ridiculous. He said, "We look like a couple of pop-up puppets." And the boss kind of got the idea. So what he did, this guy, Jin Wu, was he started standing in these meetings and using his back was better, but he was using that as an excuse because it helped him get the attention and respect. He was able to convey that when he was standing in a way that he wasn't when he was sitting. It never would have occurred to him. So that was a kind of interpersonal Aikido where he was able to turn a situation around and really, really get the credit and respect that he had not been getting. Yeah, after a while, he started sitting down. But he said that by that time, his boss had begun to treat him differently.
Yeah, and started to really actually hear him. Fantastic. I love that. You know, all of the book is just full of really good practical advice and great stories like that, Sally. And everything from managing our triggers, the stories we tell ourselves, getting sort of comfortable, not comfortable, but knowing how to respond to the reality of it's not fair. Authenticity, very interesting, how we need to make sure, even though it's an important standard for our working lives now and a real thread for belonging, to be careful we don't talk about authenticity and become trapped in that drive. And I just love the concept of interpersonal Aikido. Sally, in the book, there's a rich vein of practical advice around just what inclusive behavior looks like. Can you expand on inclusive behaviors?
Certainly. And in the whole last half of the book is basically focused on very specific and very tactical inclusive behaviors, like, you know, nominating people, you know, often we're in a situation where we'll see a call for names, for nominations, for some kind of award or recognition. When we see those, think actively, who could benefit? Who do I know that might fit this criteria? How can I think broadly about who I might nominate? And then go to that person and say, you know, I'd really like to nominate you for this. I think the work you've done fits this criteria. You know, is there anything else I could know? Because I really think it would be a terrific boost for you and something well-deserved. So we're showing them that we're, you know, an ally of theirs. And we don't have to know them that well. We want to let them know what we're doing. But also just finding out how we can be helpful to people. If we're senior, for example, we can ask a person in a more junior role, you know, where would you like your career to go? What have you learned here about what kind of position you want to aspire to in 5 or 7 or 10 years. If you have any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them because there are ways I might be able to be helpful, introducing you to people, pointing you in the direction of acquiring or working on certain skills. I'd love to be a resource. I think you've got a lot of potential. And often in that situation, especially if it seems to come out of the blue, the person will say, oh, well, I'm not sure, or I like what I'm doing now, or something like that, some answer that's not particularly helpful. And when that happens,
yeah,
we don't want to just say, oh, okay. We want to, you know, well, think about it. I'm going to come back, you know, and ask you this again in a, mm-hmm. in a month or two, because I really think you've got a lot of potential here. And I would like to be a resource for you. We can do that with colleagues as well. And this is one of the big messages in this book. This is not just something for leaders, but as colleagues, even, you know, peers, we can do this. We can let people know, I want to invest in your career. I want to be useful for you. If we're junior with someone who's more senior, we can always ask the question, you know, what can I do that's going to be most helpful to you in this position? Yeah. You know, an implicit question here is, how can I make you look good with your boss? Which is basically what our boss wants to do.
Yeah.
So now we don't want to phrase it that directly, but letting senior people know that we understand that we understand part of our role is to make them look good. And asking questions around this specificity, how can I do that? Indicates to them that we're a potential ally, even if we're someone in a very junior position. So this is mm-hmm. applicable at all levels. So I've got lists and lists of various behaviors like this. And you know, Penny, one of my goals here is to try to shift the conversation in organizations,
yeah.
which have a lot of exposure to, away from unconscious bias, microaggressions, et cetera. All that's fine, mm-hmm. but let's help people identify how they can be better allies to those they work with, especially across yeah. boundaries, rather than just telling them, you know, things like have an ally mindset. You know, I hear that advice a lot. What does it really mean? You know, break it down for me. So I'm trying to break it down for
yeah,
me.
Yeah. What do I have to do?
Yeah.
And I love that. And those behaviors themselves are, you know, people will observe that, and that shifts cultures and mindsets, because people will see that as whether you're junior or senior as being able to model what good ally behaviors look like.
Right. Exactly. And that begins to create a culture of belonging. Culture is created by all those small behaviors, mm-hmm. by our words and actions. Not by, you know, whatever's running through our heads. So we want to attend to that.
Sally, in concluding, any headline advice for the women and men listening who want to live in and help create cultures of belonging?
Yeah, I think number one is recognize that this isn't going away, that we're part of an ever increasingly diverse series of situations. This is true in our workplace. It's true in our religious communities. Mm. It's true certainly in the communities we live in. And what will be most helpful to us is to have a way of showing goodwill to people we perceive may be very, very different from ourselves, and finding out where we feel most comfortable interacting with these people, rather than going in sort of defensively primed to have your expectation mm-hmm. met. Feeling people want to feel as if they belong. People want to feel ownership
yeah.
in the organizations of which they're a part and the communities of which they're a part. And many of us are struggling to figure out how to do this. what the reason I wrote this, wrote Rising Together, is I really wanted to look at the practical hows. So it's addressing the triggers, but it's also having lots and lots of suggestions for concrete acts, for behaviors that we can practice that will help us build strong relationships with people we may perceive as being very different from ourselves, collaborative relationships. This will serve us. It will make our experience more enjoyable. We'll learn a lot, and it will certainly serve our teams and our organizations.
Thank you, Sally. You offer a real grounded voice of experience and wisdom. It's such an important contribution for everyone in organizations today, and especially minorities, and what can feel like a confusing and fraught time. But actually often our instincts do not serve us well, because it's a time that is in fact full of opportunity to make a difference. Such a positive and practical approach. Thank you so much, Sally. Sally Helgeson.
Thank you, Penny.
Thanks for listening to Grit and the Oyster. If you're enjoying our conversations, do subscribe, rate and review us on your podcast platform, and join me again soon. You can also find more information and resources on building your best leadership self on pennydevolk.com, including my blog that covers topics from how to negotiate powerfully as a woman and building your authority, through to having your voice heard and boosting confidence, all in support of building your leadership career.